Hi, this is Barbara Peters, and it is January 24th, and once again, I am thrilled to be sitting here talking to John LeSquire. Now, some of you may not know how to pronounce that, so I will ask him to pronounce it.
Well, we in the family pronounce it LeSquire.
LeSquire.
Not too big of a French thing, but a little bit. It looks, though, like Les Croardon, so that makes everybody get all lost.
One of my very favorite stories that you have told me more than once was that once you went to a Barnes & Noble.
Yes.
To do a book signing.
You're going to say John le Carré, aren't you?
I was. Well, yes. I was. You spoiled my line. Come on, you stepped on it.
But I'm sorry.
What I was going to say was, when you arrived, there was this, you know, enormous stack of books all set up, and you were all really excited.
Biggest stack I'd ever seen.
It's easy to confuse le Carré and
le Carré and LeSquire. They start with L-E. It's C, and there's a C in it both.
I love it.
Yeah.
The other thing I remember about you is, for whatever reason, we were in, where was it, San Francisco or some convention, and we were walking down the street, and I confused you with John Strahlin.
That's the story of my life. You know, it's confusion. There's a lot of confusion out there.
Nonetheless, we have been together a long time.
A long time. I was trying to figure this out. Is this like 15 or 20 years in a row?
Yeah. Well, this is our 30th year of the Poison Pen.
Yeah.
So it probably is, I think it's 20 years.
Yeah, at least.
In a row.
That's amazing.
Right. And this is, in fact, The Rule of Law is your 18th for Dismas Hardy, right?
Right.
So I find it interesting, you know, because it's an ensemble cast that you've added people to.
Yes.
But in the background, it's always been Phyllis.
You know what? Phyllis in this book just blew my mind because she came out of nowhere. She's been there, you know, as you say, she's in the background of every book as a kind of a comic relief figure almost.
Right.
You know, Hardy gives her grief all the time. And she's a, you know, long-suffering secretary who's just there to work and do, you know, her job. And we don't think of her as ever having had any kind of a personality or any kind of issues or anything she's dealing with. And like is the case with real life, she's got a lot of stuff going on in there that we may find interesting.
Well, we do find it interesting, but I really enjoyed it. As you say, she's always been kind of, no, not part of the ensemble cast, almost like wallpaper,
right?
And then all of a sudden,
well, you want to hear where the name came from?
Yeah,
this is going way back into, you know, the writer's psyche right now. But when I was a little boy, like 2 or 3 years old, my older sister Patricia used to torment me by coming up to me and going, Phyllis McGowan, whatever that meant. I mean, maybe she was was the mother of some other person, but my sister just thought it was the most terrifying name. And I cried like crazy. So she was getting all the feedback she could possibly want. And I would cry like crazy. She'd go, Phyllis McGowan, follow me around the house with her hands up going, Phyllis McGowan, Phyllis McGowan. So when I started this book, I had no idea it was going to be Phyllis, number one. Number two, I had no idea that she was Phyllis McGowan. So I've purged her persona from my guts.
Wow, writing is therapy. I love it.
Excuse me, I'm sorry.
We do. So Phyllis is the, what do we call it? I love this phrase, and I have trouble saying it.
Yes.
The instigating incident.
Oh,
arises.
I like that.
Isn't that good?
Did you teach a literature course at one time?
No, yeah. But I ran across it and I poached it because I think it's such a very elegant way of kind of saying, let's get this sucker rolling.
Let's get it going. And she gets going, I think, on page 6. It's something really way up front.
She does.
Yeah.
So the other thing I really love, and this is giving nothing away for those not having yet read it, is that Hardy, you know, he's a lawyer, and he's got a somewhat elastic view of, you know,
yes,
the law and justice, but still,
right,
basically has to stay on the right side of it. And Abe, who has progressed through several persona,
right,
the two of them break into Phyllis's apartment to try to figure things out.
You know, when you're writing books, it's the kind of thing you could never outline, because you'd say to yourself, this won't work, this just cannot work. But in fact, all of a sudden, they're talking to one another, and Hardy goes, we're going to go check this out because she might be dead, and I got to find out. And then he goes and he breaks into her apartment. This isn't giving anything away. It's on page 10.
Exactly.
But it was amazing to do it. And then to have Hardy have to live with the guilt and the remorseless stuff that he has to deal with all the time because he's such a crazy person.
Well, it would have been actually somewhat challenging if they had found her there. I had this discussion with Tom Perry, mm-hmm, a couple of weeks ago. When you set up a burglar, like Bernie Rodenbaugh for Lawrence Block or in Tom's new book or whatever, you always have this, you have this threshold problem, which is the burglar arrives and there's something terrible that's happened, but the burglar's not in a great position.
Can't be, hi, I was just wandering through your living room the other day. And happened to notice this body, and I don't know what it's doing there, you know.
Or calling 911. Or 911. Has some danger. So I thought about that. You know, how wonderful that you've taken Hardy and Glitzky and put them.
This is the year of the burglar, Barbara.
Truly.
Yeah.
You know, and what if they'd actually found Lifeless or some other person, you know, dead in the apartment?
Exactly.
And then what would the two of them have done?
Well, it would certainly be a different book. Maybe I'll do it in the new book. I'll have them break into another place.
Well, you know, it is difficult when you're writing so many books about a relatively small number of people.
Yeah.
You can bring in complete strangers from the outside, which is perfectly plausible if you're an attorney, right, or a cop.
Right.
And that's the great genius of writing about people actually in law enforcement as opposed to, like, a cat sitter or, well...
Well, because,
you know,
there are people who continue to break the law and need to be caught.
Yes, and need their services. But, I mean, the threshold problem of an amateur sleuth is how do they get to keep investigating?
Well, this is what I did with Dismas Hardy after he was the first two books as a bartender. I'm going, okay, this is moving a lot toward Jessica Fletcher's neighborhood, and I didn't want to be writing Jessica Fletcher and...
I think sending him to law school
was a pretty good idea.
It's a really good idea. Yeah, and fortunately for you, who is not a lawyer, you have an excellent friend who is a lawyer.
Yeah, he is
and
good.
He's been a very big part, hasn't he?
Yeah, he's,
of the
been,
whole series?
He's been my collaborator in all of these books. What I do is I finish the book. When I'm done with it, the first person that reads it is Al.
Right.
And he goes back through it, and he makes my editors all look like they're made out of cream cheese. He is solid granite.
Have you learned in the process of doing this to think like a lawyer?
I think I do, even though every single book, when I hand it to Al, you know, he just thinks, how can you not know this yet?
Yeah.
You know, because there's always, for all the 15 things that I got right, there's probably 25 that I got wrong.
But nonetheless, you had to at least craft a plot that was plausibly illegal.
That's because I write about people, you know, and that's, I think, the difference between some of my books and others, you know, other people who are writing legal, you know, thrillers. Is that legal thrillers don't necessarily ring the dramatic bell the way they ought to, unless you're dealing with the actual people involved in a situation. And I think I pay attention to my characters doing what they do, rather than what the law is that they are bound by.
I think that's absolutely true, and of course they're not all, you know, dynamite courtroom scenes. I mean, Earl Stanley Gardner was pretty much a template, right?
Right.
And 100% of the procedure would never have been allowed in any courtroom.
Nothing. I had a guy come up to me last night at one of another signings I was doing up in Sacramento, and this guy was a defense attorney, and he went, you know, the only reason, you know, that I read is to find somebody who gets the law right. He says, and you do. And I went, well, that's great to hear. I wish I could take credit for it, but, you know.
As long as you and Al do it together, I think it's great. So how, you know, when you're writing, I'm having a blank here, the private investigator whom I'm so familiar.
Wyatt Hunt.
Thank you. When you were writing Wyatt, did Al work or was
he
that?
He just introduced me to a PI, to a real guy.
Oh, he just introduced you to a PI.
Yeah.
I love the way you said that. Oh, he just introduced me to his mother.
Right.
Come on, John.
Yeah, I came up to San Francisco for lunch at Sam's, where we do a lot of our plotting. And
drinking,
and
right?
Occasionally there's a drink.
Right.
You know, Al drinks a little bit.
You are a noted... This man, John Lesquois, is a noted enophile. Because I know this because I've been out for wine.
I do like
more
wine
than
a little
once.
Bit. It's not a problem. It's not a problem at all.
So anyway... As one would, he introduces you to a PI.
The PI shows up at Sam's. We shake hands, and the guy says, they're all great people. I mean, because when you want to talk about people's work, they tend to get enthusiastic and happy. And it seems like it opens their, you know, their hearts. So he took me over to his shop, showed me what he worked. And I had no idea that it's all computer-based stuff now. I mean... And everything he was talking about, I found a place in, you know, the last Wyatt Hunt book.
It'd be tough to be Spencer today. There's no question.
Well, you gotta deal with the whole modern issue of how the world is run, which is, you know, I'm starting to see everywhere this kind of backlash that's happening with all of the tech stuff.
Well, you're right there on the edge of it,
right?
Not in Silicon Valley.
There's a lot of people who just go, and you know, I'm not going to take my phone with me. I'm not going to bring it to the table. you know, there's a lot of stuff going on.
True. Yeah. Right. We, in fact, opened a YouTube channel because we recognize that a lot of people are migrating away from Facebook.
Sure.
And we felt that, although, yeah, same sort of deal. But I don't have a social media presence. The bookstore does. I personally don't have any at
all. That's the same as me. My writing persona, John Lesqua, which is my real name, but that has a website, you know, and all those things, social media. But in terms of my real life day to day, it's not a big part of it.
No, I've taken up the store Instagram account because I have the superior camera, and I really enjoy doing that. But I never answer, you know, any of the comments or anything, which sort of defeats the purpose. But I figure they can just enjoy the pictures.
Now, what are we listening to here? It's a podcast out of your.
We have a podcast channel. It's on the homepage of the Poison Pen, and you can tune in. And now I don't remember. I've done maybe 20 or so.
Because you know, I've done a bunch of these podcasts, and then I'll go to another interview with someone like you, and all of a sudden you're asking me a question I don't remember talking to you about at all, because evidently whoever's been preparing for this last one has read or heard, listened to several other podcasts. And I'm going, there's no secrets left.
I haven't thought about that, but since I've already told you I do zero preparation, we might very well be treading
over. Luckily, you're a little bit glib. A little tiny bit.
Well, if we're reworking old ground, too bad. You know what? It just seems a shame not when we wind up with a few minutes, you know, which is not always the case with people's travel schedules. It seems wasteful not to have a little chat that we can share. Not everybody, you know, we video our programs so people can watch them on Facebook Live or, as I've just said, YouTube.
Yeah.
But there are people who would rather listen to a conversation than watch something. So it's just a matter of, we have such a big international and national audience.
Right.
It's all a matter of trying to let them share in the glory of your presence. I probably should end on
that
note. Right, I can't say anything else. Thank you, John.
All right. Thank you, Barbara.